Through the ages, if you go through the history of mankind, man has always had difficulty grasping the concept of God. It's just a matter of difficulty with mankind because we are dealing with a deity that is infinite and we are definitely finite. As Christians, we do understand that God is a spirit. In John chapter 4, and in verse 24, John chapter 4, and in verse 24, Jesus tells us God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship him in spirit and in truth. But how do you define spirit? How do you look at it? How do you touch it? How do you see what a spirit is? See, for the common man, without knowledge of the scriptures, the idea is basically a little too vague. And so what ends up happening, even though the Bible tells us the knowledge of God is there in creation and we can see who God is and some of his attributes and some of his nature, yet with the common man in the years gone by, God has remade in their mind into something that they can grasp, something that they understand, something that they see. So in Romans chapter 1, Romans chapter 1 and starting with verse 20. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes, his eternal power and his divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, so that they are without excuse. For even though they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks, but they became futile in their speculations and their foolish heart was darkened. Professing to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the incorruptible God for an image in the form of corruptible man and of birds and of four-footed animals and crawling creatures. The reason why it's mentioned as being foolish is because we can look at the world and we understand, you know, make a deity out of a frog is kind of odd, or a snake or a cow or whatever people worship, because none of those creatures make things, let alone make our universe. To say that mankind did it, that's, again, it's kind of odd. And yet man takes what they can grasp, things that they can see, and then make gods out of them. And oftentimes these men projected their own ideas and their own abilities onto their gods, just in a magnified way. See, when people get mad, they sometimes stomp their feet and they throw things. So when a god gets mad, well, he shakes the earth with earthquakes and he throws lightning bolts. And see, it's just taking what we do as people and magnifying it. See, the pagans also, we have to understand, saw their gods as limited beings. Their limits were less than we as people's limits, but still they were limited. I'd like to show this from the Old Testament. Ben-Hadad was king of Aram, and he decided it was time to expand his territory. We're going to be going to 1 Kings chapter 20 for a bit. 1 Kings chapter 20. And at the time of which we are considering, Israel was underneath the rule of King Ahab. We know Ahab as being a very wicked king. Ahab has been paying tribute to Aram, to this other country. Think of tribute as extortion money. Basically, they pay off money saying, you don't invade us, here's some money to keep you happy, just leave us alone. But that wasn't enough for Ben-Hadad, and he decided he was going to strip Samaria. And in 1 Kings chapter 20, starting with verse 5, it says, then the messengers returned and said, thus says Ben-Hadad, surely I sent to you saying, you shall give me your silver and your gold and your wives and your children. But about this time tomorrow, I will send my servants to you, and they will search your houses and the houses of your servants, and whatever is desirable in your eyes, they will take in their hand and carry it away. I told you to give me everything you had. You won't do it, so fine, we're going to come and take anything we feel like taking. If you think it's have any value, we're going to have to take it with us. Well, God sent a prophet to Ahab, which is kind of surprising considering how wicked Ahab is and that he didn't want anything to do with God basically anyway. But God actually sent a prophet to Ahab and tells Ahab to refuse. Tell Ben-Hadad, forget it. And so in verse 13, now behold, a prophet approached Ahab, king of Israel, saying, thus says the Lord, you have seen all this great multitude. Behold, I will deliver them into your hand today, and you shall know that I am the Lord. God was saying, here, I'm going to take this opportunity to prove to you that I'm really God. See all these people? They're yours. You'll have them. It was interesting. Ben-Hadad was so certain of a victory that he was actually celebrating his victory before he even fought the battle. In 1 Kings 20 and verse 16, it says, then he went out at noon, while Ben-Hadad was drinking himself drunk in temporary shelters with 32 kings who helped him. It's not even the end of the day. It's right in the middle of the day. This noontime. They're having a party. They haven't even fought the battle yet, but they're celebrating the fact that they're going to win. And Ahab leads a small army, about 7,000 men, and came at the kings. Down in verse 19, so then they went out from the city, the young men of the rulers of the provinces, and the army which followed them, and they killed each his man, and the Armenians fled, and the Israel pursued them. And Ben-Hadad, king of Aram, escaped on a horse with his horsemen. And then the king of Israel went out and struck the horses and chariots and killed the Armenians with a great slaughter. So exactly what God said happened. Even though they could only raise a small army relative to the size of the Armenian army, they had 32 kings plus Ben-Hadad. Even though they only had one king and basically the province leaders and about 7,000 men, wiped them out. Total rout. What's interesting, though, and this is what we want to bring up, is Ben-Hadad decided, you know what? The problem is we were in the wrong place. See, God was not the God. Their God was a God of mountains because, the capital is up on top of a hill. So we need to fight them in the plains. Take a look at chapter 20, down in verse 23. Now the servants of the king of Aram said to him, their gods are gods of the mountains. Therefore they were stronger than we. But rather let us fight against them in the plain, and surely that we will be stronger than they. Do this thing, remove the kings, each from his place, and put curtains in their place, and muster an army like an army that you have lost, horse for horse, chariot for chariot, and we will fight against them in the plains, and surely we will be stronger than they. And so he listened to the voice and did so. Okay, we're going to build up an army just as big as we had before. And we're going to do this, though, on the plains, because their God is a God of the mountains, and he can't reach down to the plains. And again, the two faced off, starting with verse 26. And at the turn of the year, Ben-Hadad mustered Armenians and went up to Aphek to fight against Israel. And the sons of Israel were mustered and were provisioned and went to meet them. And the sons of Israel camped before them like two little flocks of goats, but the Armenians filled the country. Now notice the contrast they're saying. That when you look at the Israelites' army, it looks like two little flocks of goats. And you look at the Armenian army, and it's got the whole countryside's full. I mean, they have a huge, monstrous army. God doesn't like challenges like that. Or maybe he does like challenges like that. He basically tells Ahab, okay, we're going to do this again. Starting with verse 28. Then a man of God came near and spoke to the king of Israel and said, thus says the Lord, because the Armenians had said, the Lord is a God of the mountains, but he's not a God of the valleys. Therefore, I will give you all this great multitude into your hand, and you shall know that I am the Lord. And so they encamped one over against the other 7 days. And on the seventh day, the battle was joined, and the sons of Israel killed the Armenians, 100,000 foot soldiers in one day. But the rest fled to Aphek into the city, and the wall fell on 27,000 men who were left. And then Ben-Hadad fled and came to the city into the inner chamber. And the story goes on. Okay, just to prove things, I'll show you what happens. Oh, killing 100,000 with a small army, 100,000 soldiers in one day, that's a slaughter. And oh, by the way, 27,000 of the ones that escaped got crushed by a wall that just happened to fall down. And God showed, no, I'm not a God of one location, I'm God. I want to show you this again in another example. This time we're going to look at Balak. Back in Numbers chapter 22 is where we're going to start. Numbers 22 through 23, we're going to be at. Balak wanted the children of Israel cursed. And so he sends for a prophet named Balaam. He has a reputation of whatever he says comes true. And they prepare sacrifices, and they're going to have a curse placed on Israel so that Israel will not triumph. And we are in Numbers 22, starting with verse 41. Then it came about in the morning that Balak took Balaam and brought him up to the high places of Baal, and he saw from there a portion of the people. Then Balaam said to Balak, "Build 7 altars for me here, and prepare 7 bulls and 7 rams for me." And Balak did just as Balaam had spoken, and Balak and Balaam offered up a bull and a ram on each altar. Then Balaam said to Balak, "Stand beside your burnt offering, and I will go, and perhaps the Lord will come to meet me, and whatever he shows me to me, I will tell you." And so he went up to a bare hill. The result was, instead of a curse, we get a blessing on Israel. Not at all what Balak had paid for. But rather than giving up, what's interesting is Balak decided we were just in the wrong spot. So let's try it in a different spot. See, there's this idea that gods are gods of locations. So let's move it over to this spot and maybe we'll get better reception. And so in Numbers 23 and verse 11, and then Balak said to Balaam, "What have you done to me? I took to you to curse my enemies, but behold, you have actually blessed them." And he replied, "Must I not be careful to speak what the Lord puts into my mouth?" Then Balak said to him, "Please come with me to another place where you will see, may see them. And although you will only see the extreme end of them and will not see all of them, curse them for me from there." And so he took him to the field of Zephorim up on the top of Pisgah, and built 7 altars and offered a bull and a ram on each altar. And again, they went through the ceremonies, they went through everything, and the result was a blessing. Well, what do we do now? We'll try it again in a different spot. Maybe it'll work better in another spot. So in verse 25, then Balak said to Balaam, "Do not curse him at all, or bless him at all." But Balaam replied to Balak, "Did I not tell you, whatever the Lord speaks, that I must do?" Then Balak said to Balaam, "Please come, I will take you to another place. Perhaps it will be agreeable with God that you curse him for me from there." And so Balak took Balaam to the top of Peor, which overlooks the wasteland. Balaam said to Balak, "Build 7 altars for me here, and prepare 7 bulls and 7 rams for me here." And Balak did just as Balaam had said, and offered up a bull and a ram on each altar. And the result was still a blessing. But what I want you to see is this is exactly the way the pagans looked at God. Now, oh, this location's not good enough. Let me try this location. Oh, this one didn't work either. Well, let me try this one. Now, Jonah thought the same way. We're talking about the pagans, but Israelites had the same problem. See, Jonah was told to go and preach to Nineveh, which was the enemy of his country. And he thought he could just outrun God. He thought he could go someplace where God couldn't reach. And if we look at Jonah chapter 1, and in verse 3, it says, "Then Jonah rose up to flee to Tarshish from the presence of the Lord. So he went down to Joppa, found the ship which was going to Tarshish, paid the fare, and went down into it to go with them to Tarshish from the presence of the Lord." Tarshish is basically on the far end of the known world. It's on the tip of what was then Gaul, but we now know as Portugal. Way out there on the end of that, the Europe Peninsula, European Peninsula. That we're going to get as far away as we possibly can. He's going to flee from the presence of the Lord. The problem is you can't get away from the presence of the Lord. In fact, again, God shows his sense of irony. Because God sends him out to a very out-of-way place. Jonah wanted to go someplace far away. So God sent him someplace far away. He put him in the belly of a great fish and went down to sea. About as far away as you can get. And Jonah realized there isn't any place you can go that you're not in the presence of God. Israel also wanted God to help in their struggles against the Philistines. And they thought that, well, God wasn't giving them the victory they want, so they were going to force God to give them victory. They thought they could carry God into battle. And then therefore he would cause them triumph. Take a look at 1 Samuel chapter 4. And in verse 3. "When the people came into the camp, the elders of Israel said, 'Why has the Lord defeated us today before the Philistines? Let us take ourselves from Shiloh, the ark of the covenant of the Lord, that it may come among us and deliver us from the power of our enemies.'" We lost. What do? Let's grab the ark and we'll bring God with us and he will make us win. But you know, God can't be made to obey the plans of men. And so we get to verse 10 of 1 Samuel chapter 4. It says, "So the Philistines fought and the Israelites were defeated. And every man fled to his tent and the slaughter was very great. For there fell of Israel 30,000 foot soldiers. And the ark of God was taken and the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, died." God showed who's in control here. They thought they could control God by moving God's ark. You can't control God that way. God's presence was maybe seen where the ark is at, but God's not there. God's everywhere. God is the controlling the universe. He's not in one spot like that. See, people act as if God is limited. And you might be looking at it and saying, yeah, look at all those silly old-fashioned people back in the old days with all their idols. You know, it's no different today. People still act like God is limited. After all, how many sin and act like nobody sees? Take a look at Isaiah chapter 29. Isaiah 29 and in verse 15. "Woe to those who deeply hide their plans from the Lord, and whose deeds are done in a dark place, and they say, 'Who sees us? Or who knows us?'" Isn't that just like the pagans with the idea of that God is limited in some way? We can keep it to ourselves. We won't tell anybody. We'll do it in a dark place where nobody sees us. God's not limited in that way. No darkness can hide us from God. Take a look at Job 34. Job 34, starting with verse 21. "For For his eyes are upon the ways of man, and he sees all his steps. There is no darkness or deep shadow where the workers of iniquity may hide themselves. For he does not need to consider a man further, and that he should go before God in judgment. There isn't any place that can hide us from God. Yet the workers of iniquity, those who sin, oftentimes act as if they're getting away with something and that nobody knows. Even the thoughts you have in your heart, the things that you've never told anybody, God knows what you're thinking. In fact, come Judgment Day, we're told in 1 Corinthians chapter 4. 1 Corinthians chapter 4, and in verse 5, therefore do not go on passing judgment before the time, but wait until the Lord comes, who will both bring to light the things hidden in the darkness and disclose the motives of men's hearts. And then each man's praise will come to him from God. Not only the things that you thought nobody else saw, that those are going to be revealed, but also the very motives you have in your heart. There's nothing that can be hidden from God. But, you know, Christians sometimes fall in that same trap of thinking God is limited. We've been talking about the workers of iniquity. I've seen Christians who are very pious while in the building, but they act like God doesn't notice or care when they're at home or at work. They behave completely differently. Their language changes. Their behavior changes. It's almost as if they think, well, God's here in the building and nowhere else. But you know, God doesn't miss a thing. Take a look at Matthew chapter 10. Matthew chapter 10 and in verse 29. Matthew 10 verse 29. It says, are not two sparrows sold for a cent? And yet not one of them will fall to the ground apart from your Father. If God pays attention to even when a bird dies, do you think he misses what you do? Another way people get upset and somehow miss the idea of God is sometimes Christians become upset when they become a child of God and then their problems don't disappear. I've run across people that they thought by becoming a Christian all problems will disappear and suddenly everything will be great. You know, this happened in Jeremiah's time. People were sacrificing idols in Jeremiah's time. In fact, that's one of the reasons why they were taken off to captivity, because of their idolatry. Jeremiah told them it was wrong and that they were going to go to captivity for their sins. So the people actually stopped sacrificing to the idols. But you know what? The punishment continued anyway. Because they hadn't changed their heart. They just changed what they were doing for a little bit. And in Jeremiah 44, and starting with verse 15, Jeremiah 44, starting with verse 15. Then all the men who were aware that their wives were burning sacrifices to other gods, along with all the women who were standing by as a large assembly, including all the people who were living in Pathros in the land of Egypt, responded to Jeremiah saying, as for the message that you have spoken to us in the name of the Lord, we are not going to listen to you. But rather, we will certainly carry out every word that proceeds from our mouths by burning off sacrifices to the Queen of Heaven and pouring out drink offerings to her, just as we ourselves, our forefathers, our kings, and our princes did in the cities of Judea and in the streets of Jerusalem. For then we had plenty of food and were well off and saw no misfortune. But since we stopped burning sacrifices to the Queen of Heaven and pouring out drink offerings to her, we have lacked everything and have met our end by the sword and by famine. And said the women, when we were burning sacrifices to the Queen of Heaven and were pouring out our drink offerings to her, it was it without our husbands that we made her sacrificial cakes in her image and poured out our drink offerings to her. They're basically looking and saying, look at the past. Look at how many years, decades, generation after generation we have sacrificed to this Queen of Heaven and everything was going fine. And then you warn us that, hey, God's going to punish us because we've been sacrificing to the Queen of Heaven. Okay, we're going to stop. Everything went downhill. Oh, we need to go back to sacrificing to the idols because everything went downhill when we stopped. See, they decided the original problem was they were not doing the idol worship correctly. We're going to do it better. That's why at the very end, the women said, you know what? We're going to make sure the men have nothing to do with this because it worked better when just the women did. It didn't go the way I expected it, so therefore I am going to make some changes. That's what they said. You know, I've known Christians who have given up on God when they found out that after becoming Christians, they still have money problems. They still had marital problems. Their problems with alcohol or drugs still plagued them. Well, at least back then when I was high, I wasn't aware of what was going on, so I might as well go back and be high. At least I can pretend I was happy. I've heard arguments like that. It's the same pagan idea being applied to God today. See, pagans believe there was a direct cause and effect between the life somebody lived and the punishment somebody earned. Take a look at Acts chapter 28. We can see this with Paul. Acts 28, and starting with verse 4. Actually, we'll start with verse 3. But when Paul had gathered up a bundle of sticks and laid them on the fire, a viper came out because of the heat and fastened itself on his hand. When the natives saw the creature hanging from his hand, they began saying to one another, undoubtedly this man is a murderer. And though he has been saved from the sea, justice is not allowed to him to live. However, he shook the creature off into the fire and suffered no harm. But they were expecting that he was about to swell up or suddenly fall down dead. But after they had waited a long time and seen nothing unusual happen to him, they changed their minds and began to say that he was a god. Now, their quick change of mind from being a murderer to being a god is almost humorous. Yet, how often Christians despair of life when life gets hard, and then say God is punishing them unfairly. Now, we really need to learn the patience of Job. Now, this world has not been perfected since the sin of Adam and Eve. Bad things happen to good people. Good things happen to bad people. Random events do not reflect the thinking of God. See, we get this mode of things that whatever happens, it has to be directly caused by God. Or God's either rewarding or punishing somebody. But that's not the way God operates. Does God sometimes punish or reward people? Yes. Does every good thing that happened to you be necessarily a blessing from God? In a lot of ways, yes. But directly? Not necessarily. Is every bad thing that happens to you a punishment from God? No. Not necessarily. We've got to understand how God operates. And it's not the way the pagans thought. Another interesting thing about pagans is they panicked real easily. Take a look at Jeremiah chapter 10. Jeremiah chapter 10, and in verse 2, Jeremiah chapter 10, verse 2. It says, thus says the Lord, do not learn the way of the nations, and do not be terrified by the signs of the heavens, although the nations are terrified by them. The pagans looked in every little thing that happened. Disaster. There was a meteorite shower. That means a disaster is coming. There was an earthquake. Somewhere over here. That means disaster is coming. They found reasons to panic over everything. The least little thing that set them off. What we have to learn as Christians is not to follow the crowd. In fact, the Israelites were told in Exodus chapter 23. Exodus 23, and in verse 2, says, you shall not follow the masses in doing evil, nor shall you testify in dispute so as to turn aside after a multitude in order to pervert justice. You don't follow the crowd. We want examples of that. Look at the people who have been prophesying the end of the world. Oh, it might be true. And look at all the signs. In fact, there's one that's going on right now, you know, with four blood moons, where the moon turned red. Oh, it's going, you know, this is the signs of the end of the world. I think the current one's 2015 now, by the way. You can put that on your calendar. But again, they're finding ways to panic. They see signs in everything. It's not to all, even the big things. I've seen people do this with little things. Little things like saying, oh, you know, I was wondering if I should, in fact, I had one girl that was wondering whether she was doing right or not. And she said, and the song Trust and Obey just suddenly popped up in my head. And I hadn't heard that one in so long. Maybe that's what it was, a sign from God. How about it was just your memory popped up the song that you hadn't heard in a while? But see, every little thing that happens becomes a sign. I'm thinking about breaking up with a girlfriend. If I don't hear from her in the next 24 hours, therefore, that's a sign from God that I should break up with her. Oh, she called me 2 hours later. That must be a sign from God that I'm supposed to stay with her. How about she just got lonely and she decided to call you? But see, that's the pagan way of looking at it, is everything's a sign. Everything is somehow a subtle, vague hint about what you're supposed to do. And it could go one way or the other, depending on which way you want to assign it. You see, pagan beliefs fill our society in many ways, and in all sorts of forms. It hasn't died out. We just put new labels on. And we can't let those beliefs change our view of the God who created us, who has done more for us than we know. Our God is not limited that way. Our God doesn't operate the way people expect. Our God has told us what we need to do. If there's anyone here today who's not yet a child of God, there's no better time than right now to put on Christ, to follow after His will. And if there's anyone who is a child of God, would like the prayers of the brethren on behalf. Why don't you come forward as we stand and sing the song of the celestial?